Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Extra Sound Radio. We have an interview guest today, James Hurley. How you doing, James?
I'm doing great, Ralph. Thank you very much.
You live in California, right?
Yes, beautiful, sunshiny California. Yes,
but
we're getting the heat wave like everybody else is. Yeah, well, we're cooking out here.
Ooh, we out in the desert or what?
No, actually, I'm only about 15, 20 miles from the coast, but you sure would not know it.
Oh, yeah, I lived out there back in the late 80s and early 90s. I remember one time it was like 90-something degrees. We lived about 15 miles inland, like you're talking about. We packed up the kids, we're going to go down to the beach. Got down to the beach, it was like 62 degrees, down in a foggy and everything else. We said, let's go back to the house. It's cold.
Yeah, we could use a little of that. It was 107 here 2 days ago. That's as hot as I've ever seen it here. Something funny going on, but
yeah, it's hot over here too. It's been hot over here in Arkansas too, really bad.
And humid, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't really humid then. It got real dry. The humidity was like 15%.
Oh.
We haven't had any rain over here in about worse than nothing in about 3 months. Yeah.
Oh wow.
So it's been pretty rough.
We'll do a rain dance for you out here in California.
Oh, yeah, okay. Anyway, getting to your music and stuff, when did you start get interested in music? Were you interested when you were a child, or did it kind of grow into it, or how did that work?
Oh, yeah. I came from a very musical household. My dad was a big jazz fan. He had a very sophisticated ear. And as a matter of fact, he actually spent some time hanging around with Django Reinhardt in France back in the 40s. And then he was also at the Carnegie Hall concert in 1936, and Benny Goodman and his band played there, did that recording Sing, Sing, Sing and all that stuff. So there was a lot of jazz in the household, and my mom was very tuned into the pop side of music. She's the one that came out to the yard in 1964, dragged us into the house, said, you're going to want to see this, and of course that was the Beatles on Ed Sullivan's show. So I was exposed to music was just part of our household. All three boys, I had two brothers, and my dad never played a guitar, but he always kept one in the house, and sure enough, all three boys ended up playing guitar.
Oh.
That poor guitar.
Yeah. Did you ever fight over who was going to get to use the guitar? Did you ever have arguments about that?
Well, the older one got, my older brother, Tom, he's the one that got the lessons, so of course the guitar was based around his, you know, what he wanted. And then when it came time for him to move on to another, a higher quality instrument, that one trickled down to me. And he got his, what was it? I think it was a Tysco Del Rey, and it was electric guitar. It had four pickups. And, of course, the one I was using was an old gut string guitar. And then when I got my electric guitar, it was an Epiphone Sheraton. And then my little brother got the old gut string guitar. That thing did hard time, I'm telling you, Ralph. Three growing boys. Gosh.
How many strings did y'all break on it, do you know?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. And, you know, we'd break a lot of strings, and we'd even tried putting fishing line on that thing. We did all kinds of stuff, just trying to keep it up and running, you know. And every year or so, my dad would break down and buy some new strings, and it would be this family project to put strings on that guitar, and then it would go back into service. Oh, man.
Oh, wow.
And it was,
yeah. So, I don't know if you ever heard of the Ramones. Have you ever heard of the Ramones?
Oh, certainly. Sure.
Okay, anyway, I had an interview show, just syndicated show the other day about Joey Ramone, you know, the member of the Ramones. They said he had a guitar that just had one string on it, and he played it.
Well, it worked. It worked.
It worked, yeah. I guess it worked. maybe we ought to try that too, huh?
Well, you know, I think it kept his interest, and that was the whole point, you know. If you can keep a kid's interest with music, it doesn't matter if he's playing accordion or harmonica or guitar or bassoon, to keep their interest and until the curiosity blossoms. when the curiosity blossoms, what can you do? What is this possible? What's possible with this instrument? That's when it starts getting really interesting.
And a lot of times you can discover, a lot of times people discover something about themselves. It's kind of like having a pet, you know. It brings out the good side of people when they're in music, and, you know, the nicer side most of the time, I think.
You know, I think that's absolutely true, especially, you know, when it comes to writers, you know, people that have a tendency to write anyway, and then they get involved in music, and there's a very definite therapeutic side to music, and the writing of it in particular. It's it's good therapy. All it costs is you a piece of paper and a pencil, you know?
Yeah, I've been using that for a long time myself. I got like probably 8,000 or 10,000 poems around here that I could turn into songs if I had enough money to get somebody to do it for me. I got about 15 of them turned into songs. But that's
Ralph,
about all I can afford right now.
What you need is a one-string guitar, man.
Yeah, I need a one-string guitar, yeah.
Just grab a hold and start cranking on that thing. Yeah.
So, when you do your stuff, when you do your recording, where do you go to the studio? In your house, or how do you do that?
Well, it takes so many guises. On the first solo album, that was literally, well, I called it the demos and sketches because that's what it was. That was just recorded at any opportunity, everything from little four track in a band house bedroom, you know, to full on recording facilities. I had a little studio myself for a while. And I just put all those demos together onto a single CD. And then somebody asked me if they could buy it, and I sold it to them. That's actually how I got into the record business finally after all these years. Then The Sun and the Moon, I did that at a particular studio. It's called Crooked Cork, right here in Moorpark, California. The engineer, his name was Greg Olson. He's an incredible guitarist and an amazing engineer. We did that one in, I think it was 31 days. I just went to town on it. That's the one that London Bridge is from that record, and I think I sent you Whisper. There's a jazz ballad.
Yeah, Whisper.
That was from those sessions. Really intense, creative experience, that one. The album Tempest in a Teacup, I did that mostly while I was on the road. It took almost 3 years to do that record. I was on the road almost constantly. There's a studio in Simi Valley, California. Chaz Ferry is the engineer. He was an engineer at Cherokee at the height of their powers, and he has his own studio there in Simi Valley. So I'd do some fundamental tracks there, and then I'd go on the road and I'd take the hard drive with me. And then as I was developing the songs and stuff, I'd just go find a studio while I was out, and I'd grab some tracks, you know. This guy has a great old 1962 Neumann U47 microphone, and I want a track from that with that. So I went to that studio in Santa Cruz, and that one was all the way from Los Angeles to Seattle. I recorded that all up and down the coast and into Arizona and stuff. So it changes from recording to recording. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of depending on where you're at when you get an idea or something you work on then, right?
Well, yeah. When you start the project, when you pull the trigger on the project, whatever your circumstances are, that's how it's going to be. You know? And with the Sun and the Moon, I needed that record done, and I found that studio, and I had enough money to keep the dang thing afloat for 32 days. And then with Tempest, I was on the road just making my living. And if you book it, you got to go. So
yeah,
I just made it work. I just made it work, you know. And now I'm working on one.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I'm working on one. Actually, I'm working on three albums simultaneously at the moment. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but there are three distinct, different albums in the works. The first one, and you would think the easiest, I'm recording right here at my place. It's called voice and guitar. And what I'm doing is when I perform, it's almost always just me, voice and guitar. And at almost every show, somebody will ask, do you have a copy of what I just heard? And I have to tell them, no, I don't. You know, on Tempest, my goodness, there's everything from musical saw to electric guitars to, you know, beautiful drums played by Marcos Lopez Iglesias. You know, it's a production. So voice and guitar is going to be the acoustic guitar and voice arrangements of the songs that folks hear at the shows. And then there's another one called Notes from the Endless Highway that has I got 3 albums worth of material backed up because I've been on the road so much. That's what I'm saying.
Wow. So where have you been? Do you go out international or you're in the United States, or where do you go on your shows?
Both. Internationally, I've done England a couple of times. Bangkok a long time ago. I haven't been back there since. I wish I could, but it's kind of hard to service a demographic that far away. Here in the States, I do the West Coast consistently. Once, sometimes twice a year, I'll travel from the San Diego or Los Angeles area up north of Seattle and back. Do the Gulf Coast. Last time I turned around at Key West in Florida, and I just stayed, you know, in the Gulf States. The Southwest, I play the Southwest consistently, New Mexico, Texas, Arizona. I was going to break into the Eastern Seaboard for the first time this year. I had some shows around Philadelphia and up to New Jersey. That was for September, and unfortunately I had to cancel that tour. We just didn't have the bookings to make that one fly.
Uh-oh. And I'm going to play one of your songs. I got a call I need to answer real quick.
Go grab it.
Here we go.
Excellent.
I saw the story in the news. Someone tried to share their views with someone else that just would not agree. Angry words and tempers flared. Sabers rattled, war declared. And now once again we're standing on the brink. And day after day, the sun goes up and goes back down. And nothing we can say will change the way the world goes round. Holding on to our illusions, we tumble around the sun like a tempest in a teacup while the universe goes on and on and on and on. So far, I wonder why it seems so hard to understand. Something must be wrong. Find anything to believe, convert the world and make them see your one true way, even if it takes a gun. Well, day after day, the sun comes up and goes back down. Nothing we can say will change the way the world goes round. Like a tempest in a teacup while the universe goes on and on. All we've ever become is older without becoming wise. If ever passage of time could teach us, love might reach us. But till that time, oh,
Doctor, I have multiple sclerosis and I'm having a few problems. So I had to try to get straightened out, so I had to really take that call right there.
I agree, absolutely.
Yeah, so yeah. I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to leave dead air, so I just went ahead and played the next song up. You know, could you tell
Perfect
us about
idea.
Both those songs there? That One Fine Day, and Tempest and Teapot. Could you tell us how they came about and everything, process you went through?
Well, sure. Start with the first one, Tempest in a Teacup. It was literally, I was sitting on the edge of my bed and I looked up at a poster that I have, and it's a photograph from outer space of planet Earth. And that was the actual moment of genesis for that song. That was, it struck me that there are very few people in the history of mankind that have ever seen our planet from that perspective. And I guess I just tried to imagine what it must be like to have that perspective as experientially, and what would all of our troubles and tribulations look like from out there. And
probably
that
wouldn't look very big, I don't think.
I don't think so. I think, you know, in that larger picture, in that largest and overall, you know, view, I don't think most of the things that get us all upset as individuals and as a species would kind of pale in comparison, you know. And that's the essence of that song,
yeah.
Tempest in a Teacup.
Okay, well, I got an observation that I've had before when I write a song and I get it recorded by somebody and then I play it the first time, I go, that song's better than I am. I don't believe I did that. It's just, do you get that kind of feeling sometimes, like you write something and you can do it, and then you go, wow, I didn't know I could do that, really. It's kind of scary. You know, it scares you that you did something that's pretty good. You don't know if you can do it again sometimes, you know?
Well, yeah, that's
kind of,
I think, you know, I have to confess, I do. I get a feeling like, mostly I feel like I was lucky. You know, I got I was so lucky to get to be the person that that song came through. And I hope I continue to be the train depot for songs like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. You go, wow, I'm glad I was the first one that thought of that, you know, or whatever, or that point.
Yeah,
it's like when you're talking about looking at the world from in outer space. It's kind of like stepping outside of yourself to write a song. You leave everything behind, and you're immersed into that world right there for a while. Yeah,
completely. It sort of takes you over, and that, as you know, that can last anything from 15 minutes to 27 years. You know, any given song takes whatever it takes to get it written, and sometimes. Literally, I have one song. It's not one that I sent to you, but it was 27 years in the writing. And I had to live enough to actually understand what the song needed. That's the only way I can put that. But, you know, when I was done, it was definitely done, and it was just the way it was supposed to be. And I heaved a great sigh of relief and said, okay, may I have another, please? You know, just... You know that feeling like, oh boy, I love that. I want to do it again, and I hope I get to.
I've got one like that. That I'm trying to get somebody to record, and I'm giving it to two different people, and if they've had it for 2 years, and I guess they're having the same problem that I had. You know, they're not recording it yet. I don't understand it because I know it's good.
I guess it's
kind of.
Time's got to be right. When you're writing, are you writing the melody too?
No, just the lyrics. But I have a melody like idea in my head a lot of times because I don't play any instruments, so it's just like just a humming idea, you know.
Well, see, that would
I can even
that would
come
absolutely,
up.
You know, that gives the composer something to hang his hat on, you know.
Yeah.
You know those little digital recorders.
I've got one of those, yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I usually record. I've got like about, I'm not exaggerating, you're going to think I am, but I'm not. I used to work at the Union Pacific Railroad, and when I had like a spare moment, I had one of those little micro cassette players they used to have on, you know, the cassettes fit in there. I got 150 hours of ideas. I got they're not total songs, but they're like little snippets of ideas on tape, you know. I haven't even touched. And I haven't worked for a railroad in 15 years, so they're sitting in that box in there. Somebody's going to get them one day, I guess.
Well, you know,
I have
a similar archive. I use regular cassettes. You know, I always try to keep a cassette player handy, those boom boxes. And as soon as I had an idea, be it lyrical or musical or a guitar riff or something, I just record it, just a couple of seconds or whatever it took. And then I'd go back when the tape was all full, I'd go back, and I just, as it played by, I just write down a name, the first thing that came to my mind. It could have been Black Pillow or Flarmp or just whatever came to my mind. And I'll tell you what, Ralph, I just recently I went through one of those tapes, and I could not believe the ideas that I had. And it was 25 years old, you know? And
I
don't play like that
anymore. Yeah.
What an inspiration. It's absolutely an inspiration.
Yeah, I could probably do the same thing if I went in there and opened that box. I haven't opened it up in like 5 or 6 years and listened to anything, you know, because it's hard for me to transcribe something from tape. It's hard to transcribe the lyrics from tape to paper. You know, you can talk a lot faster than you can write, you know.
Yeah, that's why they make that pause button, brother.
Yeah. Well, when you're working, if you can't pause too much, you'll get the boss on you know what.
Good point.
They were already telling me they wanted part of my royalties if I made any money out of the music.
Oh, really?
They said you're doing more music out here than you are working. We want a percentage. I got multiple sclerosis. So I got to retire early, and now they can't get none of my royalties.
They were going to have you subsidize Southern Pacific, huh?
Right,
subsidize the railroad.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, they need all the help they can get.
They must think so.
Yeah.
Well, shoot.
Oh, let's see. What about the One Fine Day? How did that one come about?
Oh. Okay. I know it's a very happy song. That song I wrote while I was my sister's caregiver during her final months. That was a little lifeboat for me.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean, because when I was going through my divorce, I was writing love songs. Yeah.
Yep.
That was my thing right then, to just put me into another place. You know, if I was writing these love songs, you know, love ballads and whatever. I got like 4 or 5 of them recorded, you know. And it's I think that's your coping. It's a coping mechanism, don't you think?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It was a very conscious and disciplined effort to stay in a mindset that was productive and beneficial to my sister, and allow myself to continue to focus effectively on the tasks that I had in front of me. That period was one of the worst and one of the greatest periods of my life. And One Fine Day, that represents that.
I kind of know where you're going, which went through my dad. He's down about 300 miles from me right now. He's 83 years old. He's in a wheelchair. He's got Parkinson's and a couple other things wrong with him. And I sent him, he just got a computer a couple of months ago, and he doesn't even know hardly how to use it. My sister had to show him how to do it. She lives with him. Anyway, I sent him some Merle Haggard songs, new ones that he had never heard before, and it was like he got Christmas. It was like little kids sing Christmas, sing Merle Haggard, or country singer.
I know Merle Haggard. I don't know him personally. I would like to. He's an influence of mine. Absolutely.
He was happier than a kid that went to visit Santa Claus over that music. He said, "You couldn't have got me nothing better than if you'd have spent $1 million." You know, that's what I'm talking about. The power of music. The power of music to touch somebody that's that sick and in that shape and still makes it inspirational to him. You know,
absolutely.
What I know,
absolutely.
I know that to be a fact. Yeah, you know?
That is magic, my friend. That is just magic. There was recently on YouTube, there was a film of a man that he'd been I think it was Alzheimer's. He had been gone for like a couple of years. He was just in the chair and just, you know. And somebody who was working on his case put together an MP3 player with songs from the swing era, you know, from his songs, his music from his era.
Yeah.
And they put those headphones on his head, and no kidding, while the music was playing, he could converse and discuss coherently with the people around him about the music and about some of the temporal things that were going on with him right then. It was amazing. It brought tears to my eyes. Absolutely. Music is magic.
Yeah, and you're... And I get an international audience on this show, and I can tell you from experience that people in some countries that have a lot of rough times, you know, that's how they survive, is through music. I mean, that's how they get through their days, you know. It's the music keeps them upbeat, you know. Because it just looks at a lot of people's situation, is, you know, it would make us all over here look like millionaires, you know.
Yep.
You know,
I'm not only aware of that. I don't want to sound like. Well, I hope this doesn't get taken wrong, but I think we here in the States are the most fortunate people on earth. I truly believe that.
And sometimes the people in the United States think that means they're better than other people. That's not really the true case.
No, they're luckier.
They just haven't had the opportunity. They just don't have the opportunities that we have here, you know.
Oh, God.
They're no different than the people. The people are the same everywhere, you know. It's just the opportunities that they're presented with, you know.
I would contend that somebody that's dealing with some of the things that we're referencing here develops a a more resilient and a stronger character and sense of self when faced with those things. I would have to say that, you know, all we are is lucky. That's all we are. And every person is responsible for making the person that they are. But it wouldn't hurt for most of the people here in the States to spend some time in the places that we're referring to, just to see, get some perspective. You know.
Yeah, it's it opens up your mind. I think a lot of people think the world ends at the border of the United States, you know, maybe Canada included, and that's about it. They don't think much past those two places. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the streets of Bangkok, my friend, you know, there's pick an African country that hasn't had a stable form of government in 40 or 50 years, and those people that are living in those places are people like you and me. And
yeah, and they're terrorized and under the brutality of different regimes and everything. That's like Libya was, you know, with Gaddafi and stuff like that that goes on. People don't even think about it. Here they go, oh, yeah, I think I heard about that. I don't really know much about it, but, you know. That's the general mindset if you go out on the street, you know. That's somebody else's problem. That's not my problem. You know, that's their problem, not mine.
Yeah, that's that mindset, isn't it? But
yeah, I think it's a little bit better than it used to be. With the, I think the internet's helped make it a little bit better though, because people are able to contact each other a lot easier than they were years ago. You know,
you're so right.
So I think it's helping bringing the world together a little bit. You know, where everybody kind of shares in the pain of it more than they could isolate it. Themselves from the pain, you know, and say, oh, I don't want to hear about what happened, how many people got killed in that bombing or whatever somewhere, you know. Now you see more outreach from people in the United States and other countries than you used to, I think, when something like that happens, like that tsunami a few years ago, you know, and the earthquake down in Haiti, you know. Like 30 or 40 years ago, that would have just been like, oh, that's their problem. We don't have to worry about it, you know. Glad it wasn't me, you know. I've been through that with the multiple sclerosis. Sometimes you get that attitude of people going, they look at you and they go, boy, I'm glad I'm not you. And I go, well, I still do some, still can do some things, you know. Not
well,
dead no kid.
Yet.
They might want
here,
me to.
Come on.
Okay, well,
come
what
over
about
here.
This?
I'll prove it to you.
What about this song down here, Whisper, you were talking about before we went on the air a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Whisper. That is, that has the distinction of being the only song in my entire catalog. Now, I've been doing this for 37 years. I counted last month, and I wish I hadn't, but there it is. I've been making my living with my guitar for 37 years. Now, that
song. I was going to say, you don't even sound 37 years old, period, so you must have started at an awful young age.
Well, I'll be 56 this year.
Age I am, 56.
Yeah. When's your birthday?
February the 8th.
Oh. Well, I'm at the other end of the spectrum. I'm the last day of September, September 30th.
Yeah, about 6 months apart or 7 months.
Yeah. Well, same bus, different seats. You know?
Yeah.
Whisper is the only song that out of my entire catalog that another artist ever recorded and put on an album, and I take a great deal of pride in that fact. There's a Scottish jazz singer named Simon Atkinson that he had a band called the Ben Marcato Trio, and they put that on their most recent album, and then Ralph. They went and played the Glastonbury Festival in England, that's the biggest festival in England. And, you know, after all these, you know, 37 years, I've never received a dime of royalties here in the States. He plays the Glastonbury Festival, and I get a check for like $150 from England.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah. Now I want to start now I want to start speaking with an English accent. You know, that was pretty
yeah.
cool. But they,
yeah.
the song is, it's an absolutely, it's been called a classic jazz ballad. And I, you know, people have promised to try to get it to Tony Bennett or Michael Bublé or, you know, any of those guys that can actually sell records because they feel that it would be really appropriate for them to perform. Well, Tony or Michael, if you're listening today, here's a song you might want to consider for your next album.
yeah. Okay. Let's play it now so they can hear it. Here we go.
Whisper. Oh, that'd be great, Ralph. Thanks, man.
Here we go.
Years go by, taking so much with them as they fly. But the one thing that they leave me with is memories of you. And it's funny how, with a lifetime between then and now, all I need to do to see you is be still and close my eyes. Who'd have imagined, after all these years, after all this time gone by, from out of the blue would come these memories of you, but they still go on, and they're still so strong. I sometimes wish I were a wiser man, disregard it when some sentimental memory comes to mind. But predictably, I give up the struggle willingly when my heart hears you whisper softly in the night.
You know.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful.
Well,
that's
got the timeless. It's got the timeless.
Yeah.
It's got that timeless feel to it, and it's relatable. It's a lot of people's situation, you know, especially when you get a little bit older like we are, unfortunately. You know, you can relate back to some things that you've done. You wish you would have done more, or something you wish you would have done a lot less of, you know, one way or the other.
That's for sure.
And it changes.
That's for sure.
You know. That really hits you when you have a when you have a health problem, you know, your past really comes back at you real hard when you first find out about a health problem like I did, you know.
Oh, I'll bet.
You start having a lot of guilty feelings, a lot of sad feelings about things you wish you wouldn't have done and things you wish you would have done, especially with your family and whatever that you won't be able to do, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's the way it goes. But I was going to ask you, while I was listening to the song and since I've been listening to you talk and your voice, now, do you do any kind of vocal exercises daily or anything to keep your voice in certain, you know, keep your range or whatever that you use?
Well, an equivocal yes, kind of. It's not a series of exercises that I do, but like if I've got shows coming up, and almost always do, I start the day quietly. And during the course of the day, I'll sing the songs that, you know, that I'll put at the end of my set that require a great deal of control. I'll sing those quietly in a falsetto. You know, if I get to the high part and it feels like I'm going to have to really push, I won't push. I'll use the other voice and I'll just go gently to that place and just keep. Basically, it's like kind of like massaging a sore muscle. That, you know, that's the way I imagine it in my head. And then usually that you know, that gives me the voice that I need to work with. And then before the show, if I can, oftentimes I'm driving an hour or more, and I'll just run through some songs while I'm driving to the show. And that kind of keeps me in the ballpark. Some nights are better than other, Ralph. Some nights it feels like you can sing anything, and other nights it feels like you're pulling your own teeth.
Well, you know, your voice, like I said earlier, you don't sound like you're 37 years old, period, much less in music 37 years. You know, you got a very youthful sounding voice, you know. Sounds like you're in your late 20s or 30s, early 30s maybe. That's what I was guessing when I heard your age, when I listened to the music yesterday. I said, that's about how old you sound, yeah.
Wow. So
I was expecting someone much younger. I was expecting a younger.
I'll be done.
Oh, maybe I shouldn't. I shouldn't have said that, maybe, but I just said
no,
it.
No, I think it's great. I'm going to tell my girlfriend.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell my girlfriend.
Tell her that. And I imagine a lot of these ladies that are listening to this. A lot of the ladies listening to this show are going to like your voice, too. I'm pretty sure I'm going to get some feedback from that.
Oh,
they pay a lot of attention. They have guys they talk with like, to, you know, they like the voice the way it sounds. And you got a nice, smooth voice, you know. Screamers, whatever, usually don't get too. Screamers don't usually get too good of attention on my folks, on my shows too much. People are getting tired of being screamed at, I think, don't you?
I got tired of it the first time it ever happened.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, everything's a disaster to some people, you know. Everything's a disaster. Everything that happens is a disaster, and it just wears you out, you know.
Having
to go from one disaster to the other, you know. I can understand
That's usually the case of folks that haven't ever really experienced a disaster, you know.
Right, yeah.
And we're back to that perspective thing. We're talking about what it's, you know, what it's like to live in this country, and not any other country, and talking about what this planet looks like from outer space. You know, it's perspective.
Okay, what about the next song I got here, this Mountain? What's kind of give me what your ideas was on that one?
Mountain. That is, it's a pretty aggressive song, and it's my take on what I see happening to the physical world that we live in. I travel an awful lot, and it has occurred to me that we are living inside a museum. You know, we've set aside little portions of the earth the way it used to be and said, okay, everybody can come and look at this. And it's like a display.
Right.
But at the same time, we're taking huge portions of the planet and paving it. And, you know, we just rip something out build something there, and then name it after what we tore out, like.
You know what the timber companies do down here? They do the clear cutting, but they're real sneaky. They'll leave about maybe 100 or 150 yards of trees right along the road where you can't see all the clear cut behind it that they've done. That way nobody knows they're doing it. And they do the same thing around here with these oil wells. They'll hide the oil wells way back off the road where you can't see them, but they're back there, you know, and they're, like you said, they're tearing up the planet with all this stuff. And then, you know, just as long as the regular people don't see it, then nobody says anything, you know. If the people really knew what was going on, like you're talking about, there would be an uprising everywhere. You know, all the damage they do to the earth, it's out in unpopulated areas, you know.
Yeah, it's well hidden.
So this is
an environmental song, literally.
All right.
I hope the folks enjoy it, because I mean it.
Okay. We'll play it right now and listen to it. Here we go.
Wonderful.
Mountain. Yeah, that one's got a little bite in it.
Yes.
Yeah. But you know, that's a literal truth over there in some of the states right here in the United States. They're taking the mountains and flattening them, getting the coal out of them. You know.
Yeah, they tear the whole thing out. They just literally tear the whole thing out. Out here where I live, there was about a half a mile, about three quarters of a mile up the canyon from me. A friend of mine had a ranch on the lowest hill around. He was surrounded by these, you know, they weren't that big, but they, you know, they were 900, 1,000 feet off the, you know, the general plain. And development company came in with those, you know, those big earth movers. Those, you know, they got a blade twice as wide as your kitchen and tires twice the size of your car. They had 85 of those things running 6 days a week for 8 months, 8-10 hours a day.
Wow.
And now my buddy's ranch is the highest thing around. They took out all of those hills and turned it into golf courses and multi-million-dollar homes. And then they sat idle for several years because the bottom dropped out of the market.
Having a little strange justice there.
Yeah. I confess I couldn't work up a whole great deal of sympathy for those guys, but they ended up filling them up, and, you know, it goes on. There's no stopping it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's almost like the kid that's looking at the last cookie. They just can't stand it. They got to eat that last cookie. They got to ruin everything.
Yeah.
You know, they
yeah.
can't leave anything alone. They got to get their hands on every bit they can touch. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I live out pretty much out in the country up here in Arkansas. I'm pretty much out in the country, you know. But you can even see signs of it out here. You know, these oil companies and the stuff that they're doing. You know. Some of it's not very nice, you know, the pollution. Yeah.
Gosh.
They discovered that natural gas places up here, you know, and they had these big companies come in here with billions of dollars putting into these wells and stuff, you know. And I'm not against oil well companies and oil wells and all that, but they sure getting pretty close to the edge of this lake out here, you know. If one of them was
sure.
to get a blow up or something, you know, it could ruin the water supply for this whole area, you know. That's pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
It gets me thinking about it a lot of times. I'm more conscious of that than I used to be. I have to admit, I was like everybody else when I used to work. That's all I ever thought about, was just my job and getting home and everything. But now when I have more time to think and see what's going on around you, you probably have that quality too. You're probably more aware of things than most people are because you have the time and it's what you do. You know, that's what you're. If you want to call it a job, you know, that's what your profession, job, career is, is being aware, you know. You can't bury yourself and forget about it.
No, you're absolutely right. It's, and traveling as much as I do, the real elemental way, my tour bus is a Honda Accord wagon from 1994, you know. I'm not well insulated from the world that I travel in. Quite the opposite. I'm very, interactive with the world that I travel in, and I see that stuff. And you know, it's strange. You come around the corner of a bend in a road that you've never been down before, and the first thing that you see is what mankind has done to the surroundings. And then I'll try to envision it before that ever happens. I've often used the phrase, development often masquerades as progress. You know, it's just not necessarily progress, though it is development.
Yeah, but I can do this sometimes. I can take one of those housing developments and be driving to it and just... In my mind, I'll try to picture, like you're talking about, I can picture what it used to look like and go, this is how many, it was trees here. Now these houses have popped up out of the ground. They look like they just popped up overnight, you know, like somebody's planted a bunch of weeds or something and just popped up over ground and overnight in your yard, you know. That's what these houses look like. They all look the same. They all, you know, no room or anything. They're bump elbows with somebody when you go out in your front yard. If you stretch your arm out, you'll hit your neighbor in the nose. You know what I mean?
I do.
They're
just, they're hives. They're cubicles, you know? And it's just, it doesn't add to the quality of the life of the people that live in them. And I don't know. I was raised around, well, earth, dirt, you know, real dirt. So I saw something on Facebook not too long ago. When I was a kid, this is the quote or a paraphrase of the quote. You've got, talking to the youth of today, you've got a mobile phone or, you know, an iPhone and a computer and da, 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 and all of these things to play with. And what we had to play with when we were kids was outside.
Yeah, outside or something that used your imagination a lot, like those building blocks, those Tonka toys and the what's called, I can't remember, Lincoln Logs and things like that,
oh, yeah.
Where you build things, you know, and
you
use your hands,
that.
And people don't, yeah, even that Etch-a-Sketch, you know, where you can sketch on that little box, you know, and make pictures,
sure.
With it and all that. But nowadays, you don't see that. I don't think there's as much creativity, physical creativity, as there used to be, you know? It's just cookie cutter,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
You look at one
right.
Town, that looks one. If you take a town of similar size, you can just about go to any part of the country and they'll all look pretty much the same, you know?
That's a real casualty of the consumer culture that we live in, the gasoline and consumer culture. Every town has to have its Walmart. Every town has to have its, you know, various and sundry stores. It used to be you go to this town for leather goods, and you would go to that town for, I don't know, pottery. You know, every location had its cultural identity. But quite honestly, I miss it. I miss things being different. Diversity ought not mean.
There's just a few places left that might be different, and I can name one of them that's not too terribly far away from me. I would say New Orleans has pretty much remained. Parts of it have remained, you know, pretty much the same, but of course it's built up around it too. But it's probably one of the most well-preserved cities, like that, larger cities in the country. I would say New Orleans would be. I don't know what you would think about that. Have you ever been there?
Well, I was just there. What was it? Oh, it was almost a year ago now. It will fly. Yeah, I was just down there. And then down in the quarter and stuff. And it retains much of the flavor. I was never there in the 70s, and I wish I had been. Because I think that was, you know, that was the very end of the post-war era. Or that's what I would consider it to be. And a lot of the time, it was before Walmart came into, you know, dominate the, you know, before that shift, the Home Depot, the big box stores and all that. So, there, you know, back then I think there were, you know, neighborhood hardware stores, and there were shoe shops where people would actually build or repair shoes. Do you remember those days, Ralph?
Yeah, I remember those, yeah.
Nowadays,
I can also remember phone booths and no cell phones and all that.
Oh gosh,
you know?
Yeah.
Oh man, I can remember when you had. I was on the work for a railroad, and I was on a 24-hour call. I couldn't leave my living room because if phone rang, I might miss a job. You know.
Yep.
People don't know. That's just talk about almost like being in jail in a way, you know. You had to tie it down to either your house or you were working. I'd rather be working than sitting there by that phone waiting to go to work, you know.
Right. Remember that there was a television show called The Rockford Files. You remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
On the
James Garner.
And the very opening sequence, here's this super sophisticated, almost, you know, he's a private investigator, and he has an answering machine. And long before everybody had one. That was a pretty sophisticated piece of gear back then. Maybe I'm a Luddite, but I kind of miss part of those days where that's concerned, you know? Anyway.
Well, you know, it's not like DirecTV, the satellite, you know, They got like 300 channels, and like Bruce Springsteen sang that song a few years ago, 50-something channels and nothing's on TV. Well, they got 300-something channels and now it's nothing on TV.
And there's still nothing.
Yeah. That's the only thing I like to watch on there are those animal shows. Now, I have to tell you, I'm pretty much like those animal shows, you know, the ones where they show them out in the wild and stuff and what the behavior, everything like that.
Yeah.
But I really can't get too much into these human shows anymore. They're so ridiculous. I mean, they've repeated everything you can do on there, so they have to start coming up with some of the craziest stuff they come up with. It's whole garbage, you know, these reality shows and stuff that they come up with over here. Unreality is what it really is. People that they have these guys that are supposed to be out in the middle of nowhere, and look, I got stuck out here in the middle of nowhere. What am I going to do? Well, why don't you tell that guy that's holding the camera over there to give you a drink of water? You know, what is it?
Yeah.
Like these survivors and all that, you know, they're out there on the island all along. Well, how did they get the cameras in? You know, and they're not aware of the camera guy standing right there by them, you know. I'm sure they never tell them what to say on those shows either.
No, certainly not. That wouldn't be right, would it?
Here's your script for today. You're fighting this guy, and this girl and this guy are going to kiss each other, and this...
Yeah, no, that's all reality.
It almost feels like, total reality. And especially with the famous people on there, you know, they're really unscripted there. You know, when they got some celebrity... you're supposedly seeing their private life, you know. Right. They're gonna go let somebody come into their house, like the Osmonds. Remember the Osmonds a few years ago, Ozzy and the gang. You know that they had total control over that. You know they didn't put nothing on. They didn't want on TV. Come on.
One thing about
but people swallow it.
They wanted stuff on TV that I wouldn't want. You know?
Yeah, they just wanted to get their name out. They wanted to keep the name going. They didn't care how they do it. I think some of these people are just the celebrity. They're hooked on it or whatever. You know, it's like an addiction to them. You know, and I've had people ask me how come I don't talk more on when I'm doing a radio show. Because the music is the star, not me. You know.
Well, bless you for that, man.
I don't like to talk up. I do more talking on interviews today. As a matter of fact, so usually I do my interviews for an hour, but me and you have seemed to be in the same common ground. I don't know why. Something karma must have been hitting me because I made this for an hour and a half, and we're probably going to need it. You know,
wow.
I go, why did you make an hour and a half? You only got 7 songs. That won't last an hour and a half, but here we are at an hour already, and we've still got 3 songs left, you know.
You bet.
I mean, something must be going on.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, man. I'm enjoying our conversation.
Yeah, it's kind of like me and you are kind of in the same relatable wavelength, I think, or whatever you want to call it. You know, we're kind of similar ages and experiences and everything, and the way we look at things seems to be quite similar to each other. You know.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't. If you talk to a lot of people about what you're seeing, or I talk to them about what I'm seeing, they think. They go, what in the world are you, what are you trying to tell me? They don't get it because they don't have that part of their mind open. It's closed, you know.
Yeah, it's either a closed mind or one that hasn't had the experiences, you know. Life
some people
will
teach
us humility, you know. Life will give us our lessons whether we want them or not.
Well, I've had people tell, you know what I've had people tell me? The reason they don't like some of my writings, my poetry, and my songs, they say they got too much truth in them. I go, well, what's wrong with that? But the most trouble I ever got into in my life was telling the truth, believe it or not. On the job, at home, anywhere you go, when you tell the truth, you'll get in more trouble. Because that has immediate consequences. When you lie, that's not the truth, so it does, a lot of times it doesn't have immediate consequences. It might have delayed, but when you tell the truth, it has immediate consequences. Go in and tell your boss on the railroad like I did, hey, I can't see the signals, I can't tell what color they are anymore. That's going to have immediate response. If you lied to them or didn't say anything, it's not going to have any response. Well, that's what I did, and everybody goes, you're nuts. You just lost your job. I go, I'd rather lose my job than my life or your life out there.
Yeah.
How you like that?
Yeah.
And I found out later on that's the result of the multiple sclerosis has that effect on your vision. It takes the color out of it. Yeah, that's one of the first early symptoms. And I had that back in about 1986. Yeah, so I mean, people thought I even got a lot of stuff from my own family about it. You know, you're crazy. You're going to lose your job now. I go, well, I can't help it. That's just the way I am. I'm not going to lie for anybody. And I'm sure. And I told people were scared of me after that. You know why? Because they knew if I wouldn't lie for myself, I sure wasn't going to lie for them.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. What were you saying about
president? I was going to make a point. You remember President Harry Truman? They used to call him Give Him Hell Harry. Well,
yeah,
Harry Truman said, never in my life did I give anybody hell. I just told them the truth, and they thought it was hell.
I get that one, yeah. That's exactly the way it goes. You know, that's what people think. You're supposed to be, you know, not say anything that's going to offend anybody anymore and all that kind of stuff. You know, well, some people need to be offended, I think, at some of the actions that they're doing. You know, that's you're not offending them. You're just telling it like it is, like you said. And if they don't like it, well, maybe they ought to quit doing it. And, yeah. Like that guy that went into that movie theater a few weeks ago and shot all those people. Are we supposed to say, well, you know, let's not hurt his feelings and tell him he hurt somebody? We'll just, you know, don't tell him that he hurt anybody. He thought he was shooting a BB gun or something, you know. He didn't know it was real bullets. I think we lost you.
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. I heard a weird noise on the line there. I don't know if you heard it. I heard a noise. It's kind of like a, sound like an interference, and then I didn't hear nothing from you. I thought maybe you went out.
It sounded like a fax machine.
No, this is a cell phone I'm on, so I don't know what it was. It's just probably a wave of interference, I guess. What about this song, London Bridge? We were talking a little bit about that one before the show, too.
Yeah.
What was the story on that
bridge?
One?
I lived in Lake Havasu City, Arizona for about a year.
Oh, yeah.
And believe it or not, that's where they keep the London Bridge. The guy that built that town actually went to England and he bought the London Bridge and he moved it to Lake Havasu City, Arizona. And there's and the city grew up around it. And when I was living there, I met the musical community there, you know, the various performers. And there was about, I don't know, 30 different acts, you know, actively playing out in the clubs. But there were only 5 or 6 places to play. So, you know, it could go either way. It could either be a, you know, like a piranha pool where everybody's tearing one another down and, you know, everybody's out for themselves only. Or it could be the way it actually turned out to be. It was a really wonderful, nurturing, mutually supportive environment. They would all come to, everybody would go to everybody else's shows. And I thought that was just fantastic. So when I was moving out of there, the night before I started loading the truck, I had this dream. It was like a Salvador Dali surreal dream, and all my friends were in that dream. So the next morning while I was loading the truck, I'd run out to the truck with a box, and then I'd run back in and I'd write down a line. And I'd load something else in the truck. I'd come back and write down a couple more lines. That's how I ended up writing that song. So all the people in the song are real.
Oh, okay. Let's listen to it now. It's London Bridge.
Great.
Underneath the London Bridge, they're dancing as the sun goes down, and Johnny plays the bongos for the moon. Later on, the crocodiles and Chucky will purvey their styles. The dancing will continue well past noon. and Mr. Scientifical and Newton discuss typical results of apples falling to the ground. While Sparky and his chromium euphonic resophonium continue to astonish and astound. Rumor filters through the crowd, dancing may not be allowed, something's happened, turned it all around. The mayor issues proclamations, there will be investigations, experts say our bridge is falling down.
The Beatles, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yeah.
You know that song, for the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on Trampoline.
Oh, wow.
Whatever, we'll all be there. Later, Pat will thank. It has that kind of a surrealness about it, like that song did. Did that make sense to you?
Well,
that's what I
thought
sure, about when I.
It sure thrills me. I think that was a great record, that's a very gratifying thing to hear.
You got a lot of characters in that song. That's why it reminded me of it so much. And then the music, some of the music that you had in there was kind of reminiscent too. You know,
beautiful.
The different effects that you had in there with what they put a lot of that in that song that the Beatles did. That's just kind of, I mean, I can remember stuff like that. I don't know if most people can, but it just brought it right back to my mind just when I heard it the second time. I didn't hear it that way yesterday, but today I go, and I know that sounds like something, and I was listening, and it clicked all like that.
That's fantastic. That's good company, my friend. Those guys definitely had an influence on the way I write. I mean, I've got influences whose names I will never know. You know, we all grew up hearing this during the greatest era of popular music in the history of mankind. You know, it's from like the early 40s, the late 30s, right through to today. I mean, both creatively, technologically, and, you know, the communication in this era that we're living in now, there's never been anything like it. So we can hear everything, you know?
What's weird? I can remember when I was like, I think it was about like 1968 or 69, I go, everything that can be invented has already been invented. There's not anything else that anybody can think of. You know, TV, telephones, you know, cars, this and that. Boy, I was wrong.
Oh, yeah.
You just, you ever wonder and think about what it's going to be like in like 50 years or 25 years from now? What kind of stuff is going to come up that we never even thought about, you know? Just,
oh, man.
Not even just something totally, you'll sit here right now and you go, I can't think of a thing that they could come up with that we haven't got now. And then it'll be there, you know.
And then suddenly, all of a sudden, there's the personal computer or the iPhone or, you know, whatever. Yeah. You know, I was down at the thrift store. I went down to the thrift store not too long ago, and I found four copies of 1950s Popular Mechanics magazine. And I'll tell you what a delightful thing to sit down and read what these guys were dreaming up. And, you know, some of them came, like, were almost right on the money, and some of them were just, nope, that ain't it. But what a ride that was. Looking at the imagination of that era and how close they were. And so you keep dreaming stuff up, Ralph. You'll end up subsidizing Southern Pacific yet.
Thanks to you, my oldest friend, I've always known. If the time should come, your loyal heart would show. So I'll ask you please to tell her, no one else could love her more than I do. Tell me, when you see her, does she speak of me? Does she ever say I'm in the dreams she sees? Do the nights go by so slowly that they take eternity? Like mine do. Maybe I should not have asked this favor of a friend. All throughout the ages, we've seen over and again. Better to be one, all in love and war is fair. So how can I be certain that the things I'll say to you are the very words you'll say to her? I think I'm not myself. Apologies are due. No more faithful friend has ever been than you. And I know it's foolish to become jealous of the moon. Like I do. Like I do.
Jealous of the moon. Well, speaking of technology, my cell phone kicked off right as we were talking. When they have the technology to keep dropping a call, that would be the best technology I think they come up with. But that's what happened there. Could you tell us a little bit about the Could you tell us a little bit about the song, since I just had to play it without any introductions or anything, Jealous of the Moon?
Well, sure. There was a girl, and we had a love affair. It was a beautiful thing. And then our lives took different directions, and we both knew it was coming. She went back to Europe, where, you know, her family, and that's where her home was. And I went back on the road here in the States. Just, you know, life will take, you know, rivers part. And so Jealous of the Moon is just exactly that. Open night sky, look up at the moon, and it dawned on me that she was looking at the same moon, but the distance between us was so great that it was insurmountable. And so all I could do was write a song.
I had forgotten about something. We've been talking so much, and I forgot to do something that I do everybody. Have you got your website and information that you want to give out?
Oh, I would love to. Yes. My website is...
talking so much.
That's okay.
Go ahead.
The website is jameshurleymusic.com. And my last name is spelled H-U-R-L-E-Y. Everybody knows how to spell music, and I imagine they know how to spell James. I will warn you, though, if you go jameshurley.com, you'll get an attorney in Santa Barbara, California. That is not me. jameshurleymusic.com. Come on out and visit. Say hi. Send me an email. That would be great.
Well, they'll just have to wait. We've only got like about 7 or 8 minutes left. I know your last song is here that you want to get in. It's Going Home. It's like 5 minutes. So, what's the story behind that one? So we have time to play it real quick.
Well, it is. You know, let me just say that looking back, we have much greater. I don't know hindsight is well more than 20/20. Maybe that's the best way to put that. A lot of people have different ways of looking at this song, but it seems to touch a lot of people, and it certainly touches me, both to play it, to perform it, and to listen to it. I think the song tells its own story quite well. I hope the listeners think so too.
Okay, well, let's play it now so we can get it, so they won't miss any of it. And it's been great having you on the show and everything.
And thank you, really, Ralph. It's been a pleasure.
It's more like talking to a friend than having an interview, really, to me.
I know, me too. It's just hey, how you been?
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go ahead and play this going home.
Okay.
Go ahead. Okay, here we go. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Ralph.
Said so many times, you can't go home again. The very thing you're looking for has changed. Even though I know it's true, still I hope I find something I remember. Still remains. I'm going home, going home. If it's the last thing I ever do, I'm going home. Thank you. summertime, I'd find what I was looking for somewhere. I can see so clearly now, gazing through the years. All I ever wanted was right there. I'm going home, going home. If it's the last thing I ever do, going
Hurley, and thanks for being on the show today, and we'll see everybody next time, and appreciate all your listeners and everybody. Till then, goodbye, good night, good day, whichever the case may be. Thanks for listening. Bye.